TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Technology and Globalization. Virtual Reality and Virtual Trade. TV, Computers, and E-Commerce. Gerrymander and Sarah Anderson. One of the main goals of economic globalization is that every place on Earth should be more or less like any other place on Earth. Wherever we travel, we already see the same urban landscapes with their fast food franchises, the same films and music, the same fashion and cars, and the same spiritual values. This statement by Gerrymander, the president of the International Forum on Globalization, is from his introduction to his talk on the role of television and computers in this process of homogenization. Gerrymander is one of the early critics of TV. His book, Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, was written in 1977. He's also the author of the recent books In the Absence of the Sacred and The Case Against the Global Economy. The homogenized landscape around us, Mander says, does not serve us, but serves the marketing and efficiency needs of the huge global corporation. Free trade agreements such as the WTO, NAFTA, or the FTAA drive forward this transformation. But that is only the external part of the process. Here's Gerrymander exploring the internal homogenization that makes us accept this made-over monocultural world. Gerrymander.
In any truly efficient or successful autocratic design, the job is also to make over the internal landscape, to remake human beings themselves, our minds, our ideas, our values, behaviors, desires, to create a monoculture of humans that's compatible with the redesigned external landscapes. So our minds and values will match the systems and technologies around us. The assignment of internal homogenization goes to the global telecommunications system. Television, advertising, computers, the internet, e-commerce, and we could surely add film, much of radio, music, the music system that is, and certainly education, which is increasingly merging with technology, as we'll see in a little while. These are the instruments that speak directly into the minds of people everywhere on Earth, imprinting them with a unified pattern of thought, a unified set of imagery and ideas, a single framework of understanding for how life should be lived, thus carrying the homogenization and commodification mandate directly inside the brains of a global population everywhere. In the end, what results is a homogenized mental landscape that nicely matches the franchises, freeways, suburbs, high-rise, clear-cuts, and sped-up physical life of the external universe. Tom Hayden once said to me that television is the biggest subject in the world that we need to start talking about again. He's right, because television is the most efficient medium for cloning global consciousness with a homogenized set of corporate values than anything else in the world. I'm going to give you a sense of its scale and impact by repeating some astounding statistics from the United States, but similar patterns can be found all over the world. You may have heard these before, but none of us have thought about them enough. They should be repeated daily like a mantra. In the U.S., 99.5% of all homes have television sets. 95% of the population watches television every day. The average home has a TV set going more than 8 hours per day, even if no one is watching. The average adult viewer watches TV more than 4 hours a day. The average child age 8 to 13 watches about 4 hours per day. At age 2 to 4, they watch almost 3 hours. That's not counting television in schools. Now, these are amazing statistics when you stop to think about them. It means roughly that half the population is watching more than 4 hours per day. How is that even possible? By heavy viewing every night and then all weekend also. People watch more TV in the U.S. than they do anything else besides sleep or work or go to school. In the U.S., television is the main thing people do. It's replaced community life, family life, culture. It has replaced the environment. It has become the environment that people interact with every day. It has become the culture, too. And I'm not talking about so-called popular culture, which sounds somehow democratic. This expresses corporate culture, and damn few corporations at that. Ours is the first generation to have essentially moved its life inside media, to have replaced direct contact with people and nature for simulated, edited, recreated versions. Television is the original virtual reality. This situation is really weird. It's almost sci-fi in its feeling and its possibilities for autocratic control. The few speaking to the many. If you were an anthropologist from the Andromeda Galaxy sent to study Earth people and you hovered over the U.S., chances are you'd report back something like this. They're sitting night after night in dark rooms. They're staring at a light. Their eyes are not moving. They're not thinking. Their brains are in a passive receptive state. We've measured them as alpha waves, which, by the way, heavy viewers get into. And nonstop imagery is pouring into their brains. Images coming from someplace they're not, thousands of miles away. These images are being sent by a very small number of people, and the images are of toothpaste and cars and guns and people running around in bathing suits. The whole thing looks like some kind of weird experiment in mind control, and that is what it is. Now, I was once in the advertising business for many years, actually. I quit that some time ago, but I learned that people really doubt the invasive power of television imagery. You are smart. You are educated. You can select from among the images that you see. But let's try a game. Let me ask you this. Can you get a picture in your brain of Ronald McDonald? Or the Energizer Bunny? Or Dave, the owner of Wendy's? Or Jerry Springer? Or David Letterman? Or O.J. Simpson? Did you know these images lived in your brain? Can you erase them? I don't think so. They're yours forever. Every advertiser knows that images are unstoppable. Your intellect cannot save you from them. Now let's move on to some other numbers. The average television viewer is seeing about 23,000 commercials every year. The intent of every one of those 23,000 messages is identical: to get people to view life as a nonstop stream of commodity satisfactions. Buy something. Do it now. Commodities are life. And this message is the same everywhere on Earth. The last time I checked the numbers, about 80% of the global population had access to television. Most industrialized countries report similar viewing habits to our own. In Canada, England, France, Germany, Italy, Russia, Greece, Poland, and many countries in Europe and South America, the average person watches 3 to 4 hours per day. In Japan and Mexico, they watch more than here. In many parts of the world, the TV they see comes from the U.S. and from other countries in the West, with very few local programs. Even in places on Earth where there are no roads, tiny tropical islands, icy tundras of the north, or log cabins, they're seeing Baywatch, the most popular show in the world. While local culture, even where it's still extremely vibrant and alive, which is true still for a fair amount of the Earth, is made to seem backward, unworthy, not good. The physical act of watching TV is quickly replacing other ways of life and other value systems. People everywhere are beginning to carry the same images that we do and are craving the same commodities that we crave, from cars to hairsprays to Barbie dolls to Palm Pilots. TV is turning everyone into everyone else. It's cloning cultures to be like ours. In Brave New World, Huxley envisioned this cloning process via drugs and genetic engineering. We have those too, but TV does nearly as well. The next question, of course, is who is sending these images? Right now, the vast majority of global television imagery, as well as film, books, newspapers, and entertainment imagery, are being sent out there to hundreds of billions of people, and now internet outlets as well, by a truly tiny number of gigantic global corporations. all of whom are getting bigger and bigger on almost a daily basis through mergers and consolidations. This process is directly assisted by the rules of the WTO and other global institutions that grease the pathways for their investment and takeover and merger. Now, we're talking about AOL Time Warner, Disney, Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, and maybe three or four others controlling a great majority of the world broadcast, publishing, and entertainment systems. So we are in a terrifying situation of a handful of billionaires in New York, Hollywood, London, and one or two other places implanting the brains of the entire global population with a fantastically concentrated and nonstop dose of highly powerful images that tell them to hate where they live, worship McDonald's and Coca-Cola, and believe that corporations are the answer to their problems. Why are we not on the street about that? Why are we not in front of Disney? Why are we not in front of Time Warner? Do we love them ourselves? That's the thing we have to start to look at, and I think it's got to be included in our activism. But okay, that's television. That's the old technology. Now we have computers. We have the internet. Now we are free and involved and interactive and independent. We can network with each other and get organized and mold the world to our wishes. But is the internet really our technology or is it theirs? Is it really decentralizing or centralizing? The ultimate politics of the computer revolution is still unclear. But it's surely the oddest of revolutions since everybody on all sides is in agreement about it. Everyone thinks it's great. The right and the left, the corporations and the anti-corporate activists, the Al Gores and the George Bushes, the engineers and the artists, all express utopian visions of democracy and empowerment brought by computers and the internet. But is this right? Is it really a new democracy? Is equity improved? We surely know that corporations are pretty excited about this revolution, and they keep selling it to us via terms like empowerment and freedom as sales points in millions of dollars worth of ads. A decade ago, we saw TV commercials showing lines of depressed men in gray suits, marching in a dreary world. Computers would set them free. Now the ads show happy monks in Asia, happy children in Africa, happy farmers in Japan, all joining the internet revolution, which you'd better do too. Everyone should think different, but all at the same time and with the same machine. Meanwhile, political leaders advocate wiring up every classroom here and in the rest of the world, costing taxpayers billions of dollars. This despite research that proves that immersing kids in computers doesn't make them happier, smarter, more creative, or more alive. Maybe the opposite, alienated, lonely, and depressed. Kids don't learn better from computers. They learn best from nature, other kids, live play, teachers. All right. But we're in a technological stampede. We live in a technological utopia, and we're in technological freefall. But are computers empowering? Well, yes and no. They serve us well in many ways. There's no denying that. Even I don't deny that. But what's the rest of the story? Privacy and surveillance. Make a purchase online and you're automatically adding to huge accessible data banks that know everything about you, your job, your family, your buying habits, credit status, social security number, and habits you might rather nobody knew about. Computers have let loose the greatest invasion of privacy in history, and there's a thriving industry selling data about you. The same technology can be used in the workplace to achieve a kind of surveillance impossible till now. Anyone with a clerical job has to worry a lot about having their keystrokes counted or how long it takes to complete a phone transaction. I'm not even mentioning its uses in military or police surveillance or corporate-to-corporate surveillance. Are we empowered yet? Toxics. They love to describe that as a clean industry, unlike those dreadful smokestack industries, but the real difference is that the junk from computers goes into the ground and water rather than the air. Computer chip manufacturers are responsible for more Superfund sites than any other industry, especially in California. And we now realize that silicon chip manufacture requires huge amounts of pure water, making a global water crisis much worse very rapidly. E-commerce. Sarah Anderson on the panel is now midway in a giant study of the social, ecological, and economic effects of e-commerce, and we'll hear from her in a minute. But let's return to the central issue, the politics of the computer revolution. The editors of Wired magazine like to say that the computer revolution has brought a new political structure to the planet. The symbol of today is no longer the atom, it's the web, a decentralized form. The political center is now diminished, they say, and the new web structure, quote, elevates the power of the small player. It also brings a new techno-spiritualism, says Wired. Okay on that last point, techno-spiritualism. Judging by the amount of the people ritually engaged with their computers, I would say techno-spiritualism is already here. But as for the political point that the old political center has been wiped out by PCs and email and web pages, and that we're now in a new computer-enhanced democracy through cyberspace, let me ask you this. Should we call that virtual democracy? I think so, because somebody forgot to tell the transnational corporations in Tokyo, New York, London, Brussels, and Geneva that the real power is no longer in the center and that they have lost control. The news might surprise the 200 largest corporations in the world that amount for 30% of all economic activity on the planet. They don't seem to have noticed that they lost power. They keep cutting down forests, building huge dams, monopolizing oil, dominating communications, controlling publications. They act like their powers are growing. Computers have had a central role in encouraging corporate giantism. In fact, the modern global corporation would not exist at its present scale, operate at the speed that they do, without the global networks to keep their 1,000 armed enterprises in touch 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. They use the same networks to instantaneously move billions of dollars in assets around the world without the ability of any nation state to observe it or regulate it. So what kind of revolution is this? To use a term like individual empowerment to summarize the effects of the computer revolution is badly misjudging the ultimate social, political, and economic outcomes of this revolution. While the internet and computer surely can help us feel powerful and are terribly useful in very many ways, as I've said, while we're emailing and networking among our virtual communities, global corporations use these same instruments at a scale that makes our use pale by comparison. When they hit their keys, they move billions of dollars from banks in Geneva to, say, Sarawak, and a forest gets cut down. Or they buy billions in national currencies, resell them an hour later, causing whole currencies to crash. While we move information, they express power. There's a difference. And in conclusion, I'll say there's a homily to remember. It's not just who benefits from this technology or any other. It's who benefits most. It's like dear old George Bush's tax plan. He says everybody benefits, and everybody does. But who benefits most? You may get a $100 rebate at the end of the year. He and his friends get hundreds of thousands. So it is with the computer revolution. It's not the small player that benefits most. It's the big players. And for the rest of us, it's a net loss. I think that someday we will conclude that global computer networks that we've celebrated for their democratic potential, that we call empowering, are facilitating the greatest centralization of unregulated, unaccountable global corporate power ever. It's crucial for democracy and for our own effectiveness that we think this through. It's not that we should give up computers, but let's stop calling them empowering. Thank you.
That was Jerry Mander, recorded at the Teach-In on Technology and Globalization that was organized by the International Forum on Globalization in New York in early 2001. Jerry Mander is the president of the IFG and senior fellow at the Public Media Center, a nonprofit advertising company working only for environmental and social causes. Next, you will hear from Sarah Anderson. She's the director of the Global Economy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Sarah Anderson says that e-commerce might make up 25% of international trade by the year 2003. She quotes a staff person from the Institute for International Economics, who's aggressively promoting e-commerce to third world countries. Here's the argument used by that institute.
E-commerce is the last ticket on the development train. In other words, if you don't buy this ticket, The development train is taken out of the station. You can forget it. Your country is hopeless. And, you know, that's the kind of pressure they're putting on. And, of course, to buy that e-commerce ticket, what do you have to do? Well, they have a number of hoops that that they want countries to jump through to get that e-commerce ticket. The first one has to do with taxation. When it comes to e-commerce and the U.S. government, they say, oh, you can't bother these businesses with taxes. They're new businesses. Taxing them would be like strangling the baby while it's still in the crib. And, you know, to be honest, they haven't had a very hard time obtaining this goal because, as it turns out, e-commerce is very hard to tax to begin with. What's particularly difficult is taxing online transactions that deal with goods that are transmitted electronically. So when you download things like music, books, financial data, these kinds of things, it's very difficult to track. But even for goods that are ordered online but then delivered through traditional means, it can be very challenging, especially from the point of view of developing countries. Most of the things that are purchased online are going to be coming from companies in the United States, so they'll be imports. And they could slap a customs duty on them, but the process of having to screen every individual package that's coming through, assess a tax, and then collect it is a tremendous administrative hassle that most countries aren't up to. So we've got a big mess here when it comes to taxing e-commerce. But the U.S. government, instead of saying, "Whoa, let's take some time and try to, you know, address this problem," are really doing just the opposite. They're trying to push through, you know, take advantage of this confusion to push through measures that'll make it very difficult for countries to be able to tax it in the future. And they're doing that in all these different arenas: WTO, FTAA, and so forth. The second one is they're telling governments they have to privatize their telecommunications sector. And the argument is that a modernized, less costly system is necessary for e-commerce expansion, and the only way to get that is by privatizing. And they throw around all kinds of numbers about, you know, countries that have privatized have so many more telephones and the overall rates are cheaper. But there are a lot of things they're not talking about. There are a lot of countries where overall rates might have been cheaper, but really only for big businesses, and the rates for average users are much higher. When they privatize telecom, they tend to lay off a lot of people who had fairly decent jobs in that sector. And also, one reason why state-owned telecom systems aren't doing too well in many developing countries is because the World Bank and the IMF tell them that they can't invest anything in them unless they privatize first. So there are a lot of serious issues that developing countries should take into account there. Instead of just buying this line from the U.S. government that it's a no-brainer, they should also be suspicious because, of course, you know, who would be the biggest beneficiaries of this? It would clearly be the U.S. corporations that dominate the telecom market. And I was thinking about it when Jerry said, you know, it's not a matter of who benefits, but who benefits most. And most of the top telecom companies in the world are based here. The last thing I'll mention that they say governments have to do to get this e-commerce ticket is to lift barriers to imports of information technology. So to lift tariffs on computers and software and all that stuff. And, you know, I have to admit, in many cases, this could be good for consumers. It could lower prices at computers in their country. But on the other hand, there are some governments out there that would like to develop their own domestic computer businesses and to try to compete with, an industry that is so dominated by the U.S. right now would be very difficult unless they did have some kind of protections for a domestic industry. So those are the three areas that have been really, front and center on their agenda. I'm going to take just the last few minutes here and talk about three things that haven't been on the agenda, but I think should be discussed. One is the environment, and the environmental impacts of e-commerce are not well understood yet, but there are some clear reasons for concerns. First of all, many purchases over the internet are delivered then overnight by air transport, and that takes up about five times as much fuel as things are developed that are transported through trucks. Also, some people argue that online shopping makes it so easy that we're going to become, you know, even more shopaholics. And this will just contribute to the big problem that we already have with overconsumption. Another area that's not well analyzed yet are the labor impacts. Obviously, the first people you think of who might be affected are the people in the traditional retail kinds of jobs who sell things actually face-to-face with people, or bank workers who could be undercut by online banking. Those kinds of jobs are clearly at risk. And then finally, I think there are some issues about how e-commerce might affect our social relations. You know, it's a less tangible thing, but I think very important. If e-commerce is really going to expand in the way that they say, this definitely will reduce the kind of face-to-face interactions that we have now. Also, it will definitely hurt many of the small independent businesses that, you know, I would argue help create the kind of economic interdependence that's important for stable communities. E-commerce encourages you to live in a virtual community as opposed to a real community. And there are some studies that have shown that people who spend massive amounts of time on the internet do tend to say that they feel, you know, lonely, depressed, isolated. And these are all things that I think need to be studied more. You know, in conclusion, I just want to say that I think the U.S. government is out there encouraging, you know, just a stampede to get those e-commerce tickets, to get on that train. And I just want to raise these concerns and say, before we get on that train, I think we should look at, you know, are the tracks broken? Is the engine going to explode? And where is it exactly that we're going? Thank you very much.
That was Sarah Anderson from the Institute for Policy Studies. She has published dozens of studies on the impact of trade and investment liberalization on communities, workers, the poor, and the environment. Jerry Mander and Sarah Anderson were recorded at the Teach-In on Technology and Globalization, organized by the International Forum on Globalization at Hunter College, New York, in early 2001. I hope you have a pen handy for more information. You can find links to the websites of the organizations mentioned today on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. You can get a copy of today's program with Jerry Mander and Sarah Anderson on TV and computers for $12. TUC Radio is listener-supported. Your tape order helps us continue our work. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to do this. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gallardon. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.